Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He is the recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, The Driver, an exclusive look inside the mysterious death and life of the world's most dangerous terrorist, not named Osama bin Laden. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
It's good to be here.
And Mark, of course, we've just experienced these two Boston bombers. The idea that a couple of, as the uncle described them, a couple of losers with pressure cookers were able to shut down a major American city for a whole week and garner the headlines and generate all this hysteria is pretty extraordinary. Considering the rank amateur nature of it all, I mean, how much is our response to terrorism a self-inflicted wound?
My view is that quite a bit of it is self-inflicted. I was really puzzled by the reaction of law enforcement agencies and the intelligence services and the FBI to the Boston incident. And I don't mean to diminish the I don't mean at all to diminish the three people who were killed. It was a terrible tragedy, but I mean, after all, we're talking about juvenile delinquents. These aren't international masterminds by any stretch of the imagination who are dealing with terrorist networks that really pose a threat to our civilization. They pose no threat whatsoever, and yet we spent, I think, billions of dollars, thousands and thousands of hours of intelligence time in, you know, in exaggerating what they represented. What they represented has been a part of human civilization since we were in the caves. It's there isn't anything new about this at all, and I do think we exaggerated its impact.
Well, I've talked to some specialists who've talked about the terrorism industrial complex, which was a term that Colin Powell coined some time back. Yeah. And there is this feeling that the trillion-plus dollars that have been spent on Homeland Security, on this very amorphous agency where nobody's quite sure what they do, is not value for money. The cost-benefit analysis has never really been done. Every day, 15 Americans die in the workplace. Nobody cares about that. We've seen all those children slaughtered in a schoolyard, and nothing apparently can be done about that. I just wonder, as a nation, you know, whether our priorities are right, the least of which, of course, is we're not getting value for money in terms of this terrorism industrial complex.
Well, several years ago, I was invited to a kind of a closed-door seminar put on by the intelligence services at the University of Texas. And airplane fare was paid, so I got on a plane and flew down there, and it was an extraordinary briefing, day-long briefing on international terrorism networks, and we sitting in the audience, you know, most of us duly took notes or listened carefully, and I certainly listened very carefully, and Al-Qaeda and its affiliated networks were described as 18 to 25-year-old young men disaffected and alienated from their societies and unemployed, and I thought, and I asked, what's the difference between Al-Qaeda then, under that description, and the Crips in L.A., or any Chicago gang, or any adolescent problem? And the intelligence service briefer looked at me and shrugged his shoulders and said, well, there's no difference. And I thought, well, why are we deploying the 82nd Airborne to fight these people? Why isn't this a policing problem? Why aren't we affecting more coherent and competent and capable solutions to this than building a national, as you say, or a terrorist industrial complex, terrorist military industrial complex to deal with it? It just seems to me that, probably an unfortunate term, but this is overkill. You know, we've hired thousands of people, given them classified status to gather intelligence on the American people, the vast majority of whom wish our society no ill will, and it's breaking the bank.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He has an article at Foreign Policy, The Driver, an exclusive look inside the mysterious death and life of the world's most dangerous terrorist, not named Osama bin Laden. And the fact of the matter is, Mark, that the two brothers in Boston were actually caught by the police in large, it was a police matter primarily, and on the intelligence side, of course, there's been obviously some kind of failure there with the Russians flagging the guy, telling the FBI about it, and then telling the CIA about it, and somehow this older brother was able to go back to Dagestan. The Russians let him in and let him out. The INS wasn't even flagged about him. You know, we have this massive counterterrorism center at Tyson's Corner. We're spending billions on this stuff. A bunch of these Beltway bandits have gotten incredibly rich out of these computerized algorithms and others, and Michael Chertoff with these scanning machines at the airports, and all of these people are making money out of this damn thing. But my understanding is it's a white elephant, that the algorithms don't work, that there is no technological fix to tracking terrorism, that you basically need human intelligence. And the FBI is not an intelligence agency. It's a law enforcement agency.
I think the big secret here, and sooner or later we're all going to know about it, is there are people inside the FBI who agree with us and agree with what you just said, that we're spending far too much of American taxpayers' money on you know, technical solutions to what is really a gumshoe problem. Local policing, good on-the-ground intelligence. There isn't a satellite in the world that can tell us what was going to happen on Boylston Street in Boston. There isn't a guy sitting behind the desk looking at a map of Afghanistan who would be able to predict that, you know, two kids from Chechnya or Dagestan would set off a bomb at the Boston Marathon on what appears to me to be just a lark. There isn't, the terrorism military-industrial complex can't solve this problem. It's going to take local policing, and overseas it's going to take people who know these societies and speak the language and are accustomed to working in these societies to really protect us. And at the end of the day, we're not going to be able to protect ourselves from anybody who just on a whim decides he wants to kill some people. This has been a part of our history from forever. So instead of spending billions of dollars in building huge centers, as you noted, Tyson's Corner out here in Washington, and hiring thousands of people and giving them a classified status to spy on us, maybe we ought to start taking apart that complex and putting laws and people into place that are cheaper and much more effective. I think we're a ways away from that, but I think that's the solution.
Well, of course, the unfortunate part would be that if this Boston bombing results in lawmakers saying, well, you know, we need more intrusion into people's internet, what sites they look at, whether they visit jihadi sites and stuff like that, and that that's where the system broke down. That's what I'm afraid of, that this will be an excuse to limit our civil liberties for everybody.
Yeah, I think that is a very real danger, and I think that process has already started. They're monitoring people on the internet. I don't think there's any question that that's happening. They're monitoring people's access to information and asking why people need certain types of information. They're intruding themselves into our everyday private lives, and there's a cost to pay for that. We start losing our civil liberties, and soon, you know, they're going to be gone. I keep waiting in the wake of Boston for people to stand up and say, you know, this is a little bit overboard. I was watching CNN, which of course got the story wrong, but I was watching CNN after these two young men were, one was killed and one was arrested, and they were interviewing people as far away from Oklahoma on the streets of Boston who had come to grieve this event and who were, you know, proud of Boston and all this other stuff, and I thought, you know, this is a little out of whack. It's a little, there's no perspective here. If you live in Pakistan or Afghanistan or anywhere in the Middle East, even if you live in Europe, you understand that the cost of having a civilization can be high, and that People die, unfortunately, and that you have to remain vigilant. But you can't build perfect societies, and things like this are going to happen, and you have to do the best you can to counter them. But you can't build societies based on fear, and you can't, as you point out, start to take away liberties. And it's a real fear that that's going to happen here.
And Mark Perry, again, author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His most recent book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And he has an article, Foreign Policy, The Driver, an exclusive look inside the mysterious death and life of the world's most dangerous terrorist, not named Osama bin Laden. And just to contrast the two Boston bombers, and it turns out that they're hapless friends seem equally stupid, and you use the term juvenile delinquents in covering up some of the evidence which they were arraigned for yesterday. The guy that you wrote about, that you write in the current issue of Foreign Policy, Mugnir, he really was a incredibly clear and present danger. I mean, wasn't he behind the architect in many ways of the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, the bombing of the Marines? I mean,
you have a good memory, a good historical memory. That's exactly right. Behind the U.S. Embassy bombing of Beirut, this is back in the early 80s, 1983, the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, the French paratrooper barracks, any number of hijackings, TWA flight, in the 80s. His cousin was behind the bombing of U.S. installations in Kuwait. He bombed a Jewish center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and kidnapped Americans in Lebanon throughout the 80s and into the early 90s. As we say, he was the real deal. He was a real ruthless SOB and bloodthirsty and bloody-minded, and we could never get him. We could never get a track on him. We never even came close to arresting him. He died in 2008 of a car bombing, and we're not the ones who were behind that, or even the Israelis. The Syrians killed him for internal political reasons, my article shows. Here was a man who was a real terrorist, and when I watched the Boston bombings and I saw the videotape of those two young men, you know, walking down Boylston Street, I thought, well, they're going to get these guys in a heartbeat. And you were right to point out it was the local policing that did it, and they did get them.
No, well, the most photographed spot on the earth, you know, the end, yeah, of the end of the Boston Marathon.
That's exactly right. But Mugnir, we had three pictures of him. I talked to a man hired by the CIA to provide a sketch of him for them, and he couldn't because they didn't have a photograph of him. They didn't even have a good description of him. And this was years after the barracks bombing in 83. So this guy was quite different and a real threat, and that's the threat that we ought to be focused on.
So who was running him? Wasn't he being run by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps? I mean,
Once again, you have a great historical memory. That's right. The Iranians came into Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War in the 70s, and they came into the Bekaa Valley and set up a training center for Lebanese Shias. And he showed up there as a young man, and he had incredible leadership skills, and they gave him training. And then when Israel invaded Lebanon and the United States followed as a peacekeeping force, Iran, it was Iran who loosed him on the Israelis and Americans, and he cost us a lot of lives.
And was he taking direct orders from the Supreme Leader?
Yes, he was taking direct orders from the Supreme Leader, and he was really one of the builders of Hezbollah. They've always denied, to me, prior to his death, they had always denied my meetings with them that they even knew who he was. But he was very close to Hassan Nasrallah, and he ran their jihad council, their military council. He was very attracted to and had a strong appetite for the Iranian Revolution, the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, and became one of their, they would consider him a great military and resistance thinker. But he had no compunction about setting off bombs and taking lives.
So, Mark Perry, as you point out, he was the real deal as opposed to these amateurs that are causing such hysteria here in the United States. But given that he was the real deal and that he was run by the Iranians and was incredibly successful as far as their strategy is concerned, killing the U.S. Marines, blowing up the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, blowing up the Jewish Center in Buenos Aires, and so on and so on. And yet he was killed by the Syrians. And here we have a situation now where Syria and Iran and Hezbollah are all allied, the Assad regime and Hezbollah and the Iranians are all allied. So nothing happens in Syria without Assad knowing about it and the Muhavarat that he runs. So explain to us why the Syrians killed Iran's most successful terrorist.
Well, at the time, and we have, it's not that long ago, and yet people don't remember. At the time, Syria was trying to shape an opening to the United States and to Israel. And they were having talks through Turkey with Ehud Olmert's government at that time in Israel about getting back the Golan Heights, which is occupied by Israel as a result of the 73 war. And Syria was making some very key strategic decisions in turning towards the West. I can remember talking to the ambassador from Syria here, and he said, we look at ourselves as a Mediterranean country. We look west and not towards Iran. And it was a clear message that they wanted to begin to maneuver their way out of the axis of resistance, as it was then called and still is, and towards the west. And Israel had, as I explained in the story, Israel had some conditions that they wanted Syria to meet before conducting open talks with them, and one of them was the death of Imad Mughni, and the other was the end of the nuclear program, and lo and behold, both of those things were done. Imad Mughni was assassinated when the Syrians were in charge of his security, and the Israelis bombed the Syrian nuclear program without any response at all from the Syrians. And I can remember at the time talking to people in Hezbollah, and they accused Syria of flirting with the Zionists. And I thought, wow, this region is really on the verge of some significant changes. And what do I know? The significant changes were the Arab Spring, and not Syria's move into the away from the axis of resistance and looking towards the Mediterranean at all. So here we are now. How many years later? 5 years later, and everything has changed because of what happened in Cairo, but not only that, but what's also happened in Syria.
And so this is the regime that wanted to be accepted and integrated into the West, and now, of course, is as a result of its own people being influenced by the Arab Spring and the Assad government doing what they always do, which is ruthlessly suppressing any dissent. You have this hideous mess that's going on now.
Well, do you remember the scene from the Godfather where the Corleones decide that they're going to get out of New York and go to Las Vegas and not be the Corleone crime family anymore? They're going to go legit. And they never could quite do it, could they? And they started killing their own at the end of the movie. And it's very reminiscent of what's happening in Syria. I think that the regime of Assad really wanted to become legit. But when there was an uprising in Daraa, they just couldn't help themselves. They had to shoot their own people and dig in their heels and turn back towards their old ways and become what they've always been, which is an oppressive regime that...
Well, I think your analogy with the mafia is actually correct. They are a mafia family.
They are, indeed.
And they run the whole place like a plantation. But just in closing, though, will we stop throwing good money after bad with Homeland Security and the terrorism industrial complex and these burgeoning no-fly lists and this database with 700,000 names in it? I mean, they're getting nowhere. It's a boondoggle, for God's sake.
It is, and I'm hesitant to be optimistic. But, you know, somehow the American people, what was it Churchill said? The Americans always do the right thing after trying everything else first. And I think that that's probably, at some point, maybe not tomorrow or next week or next year, but inevitably and eventually, the American people will say, this isn't working, and it's too costly, and we have to get beyond it and start acting like adults and stop wringing our hands and put in place good policies that protect our freedoms at the same time that protects our security. I think that that day is coming simply because the current system doesn't work, and it's an incredible waste of money.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Perry.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry. He's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's a recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award, and he has an article at Foreign Policy, The Driver, an exclusive look inside the mysterious death and life of the world's most dangerous terrorist, not named Osama bin Laden. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former FCC commissioner.